This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. It's the holiday season, and some of you may be about to go on a holiday to a different city, a different state, or even a different country. But sometime soon in the future, you may be able to consider going to a different planet altogether. And sooner than you think too. In 2018, Elon Musk's company SpaceX plans to send two private citizens on a week-long trip around the moon. But will that really happen? I'm speaking today to Dr. Patrick Collins, a professor of economics at Azabu University, Japan. He's been an advocate for space tourism and space economics for the past 30 years. Patrick, could you elaborate on the concept of space tourism to me?
Well, it's the idea that just going to space and spending some time there and coming back again is incredibly fun. You've probably seen astronauts when they're interviewed. They all say that. They all say, it's just the most interesting thing I've ever done in my life. And they say things like, I'd go back tomorrow if I could, and things like this. And I think many people know this. It's just a very different place to be from the Earth. First of all, you've got zero gravity, so you're floating. Everything is interesting like that. And you've got this fantastic view of the Earth changing all the time through the windows, and then the view out to space where you see the stars much, much better and so on. You know, the image of space travel is that, you know, you have to be an astronaut to be able to do that. So really super fit. And only, what, about, you know, a dozen people in the whole world can get to space each year. But actually, there's no need for it to be like that at all. Interesting, this year is the 75th anniversary of the first rocket flight to space. 1942, October the 3rd, the brilliant German engineers achieved that. That evening, they had a party. I mean, of course, it was wartime, so they had to be building rockets for missiles. But once the rocket had succeeded, they had a huge party that evening, and they toasted space travel. They said, you know, a terrible war. Once the war's over, let's do space travel. But they've still never been able to do that. And so a number of us in different countries around the world are working to do that. And the easiest first step is to just go up and come down again, you know, not go into orbit where you stay there, but just go up and down for about 5 minutes. You fly up, and once you've cut off the rocket engine, you go up and then you come down again, just a five-minute trip. But even that seems likely to be very, very popular, and you may know that some companies in America are developing vehicles to do that, and they've got, I think, about 700 customers now who are going to pay $250,000 to just have that experience. So just going to space is itself interesting. And the engineers who do this, they say it starts off very high price, but if 1 million people a year can do that, then it'll be down to a few thousand dollars a person. So I think it's a project that will just grow and grow and grow, just like aviation. You know, the LCCs now are so low cost. No one could have believed that 50 years ago, how cheap it would get. And space travel will be just the same.
Is there history to space tourism? Have people gone to space as tourists before?
That's right. A few people have, but so far the only people who have are multimillionaires, because the only way to go today is you go to Russia and you pay them about $25 million to ride on their Soyuz rocket. That's what we call expendable rocket. You know, it's like all the rockets today. They're just used once. You fly up to space, the rocket falls in the sea, and then you have your time in the space station. So it's very expensive, you know, if you throw the vehicle away every time. What's fascinating is that even Americans today, to get to space, have to go to Russia, pay a very large price, and get permission to fly on their rocket. And this rocket, the Soyuz rocket, is the same rocket that carried Yuri Gagarin, the first person ever to go to space, in 1961. So an extraordinary situation. The space agencies of the world have spent $2 trillion since then. And the only way to get to space is still to fly on the first rocket that ever took a passenger to space. So it's an extraordinary situation. A huge lot of technology has been developed, but never been used to make space travel cheaper. So far, I forget, it's about 10 people, maybe, multimillionaires, have spent that money, $20 million to $30 million, taken a trip on the Soyuz to the space station and then come back again. So it's still a very elite group, the space tourists.
I just can't, you know, really fathom the idea that we're still using the same rockets from the 1960s, because, you know, there's so many technological developments in the world now, and it's strange that something as advanced as rocket science is still so old, you know?
Absolutely. You're exactly right. When you think of the level of technology in 1961, I mean, it's almost unbelievably far in the past. We didn't even have handheld calculators in 61. We didn't have color television. We didn't have fax machines or videos, anything like that. I mean, all of the modern stuff has happened since then. And it tells us several things. And one of them is that rockets are not a very complicated kind of technology. They were very successful already in this was designed in the 50s, you see, this rocket, the Soyuz. It uses very low temperature liquid oxygen, so this is a key technology. But then the engine itself, the exhaust is several thousand degrees. So it's quite advanced engineering, but it's not, by modern standards, it's not at all difficult, you know. And it's extraordinary. And it also shows that space agencies have made no effort whatever to make space travel available to the general public. And it also shows that if money is spent using all the modern technology, you know, computer design systems and all the new materials, you know, titanium and all of this kind of stuff, it will be absolutely possible to reduce the cost of flying to space by at least 99%. Just like air travel has, the cost of traveling, you know, say before the war to now, it's about 99% reduction.
So right now, who are the biggest players in space tourism and what exactly are they offering?
The company that's thought to be leading at the moment is this company called Virgin Galactic, set up by Richard Branson, who set up the Virgin Airline. He's making a vehicle for suborbital flights. As I said just now, it just goes up to space for 5 minutes and comes back down again. They first announced they were going to start flights in 2008, so they've taken a long time. And they had an accident a couple of years ago, which delayed them further. But I think they'll get started maybe 2019, maybe next year. I would think fairly certainly by 2020. And then there are two other companies at the moment which are kind of in the news a lot, developing private companies developing lower-cost launch vehicles, and one is SpaceX. But they're not developing a suborbital vehicle. And the head of the company, Elon Musk, he said he's not interested in space tourism. You probably know he wants to send people to Mars. Well, that's fine, you can send people to Mars, but it's not a business, and it doesn't really affect the rest of us because there are millions of people who would like to take a trip to space but don't have the time or money to go to Mars. And then the other one is Mr. Bezos, you know, head of Amazon, and his company, or the project he has is Blue Origin, which is a suborbital vehicle. Not a winged vehicle, but just a vertical up and down vehicle. He's had several successful flights so far, not carrying passengers yet, but he should, I would think, get started in a couple of years. So Virgin and Blue Origin are the current leaders. There was another company called X-Corp, which had a little space plane project, but unfortunately they couldn't raise the money they needed. And this is the only factor holding things back. There's plenty of very realistic and practical designs and ideas for how to do this, suborbital flights. But they need about $100 million to get a prototype and so on. The first steps can be done for a few tens of millions of dollars, but it's not pocket money. And so it's sad that it's still taking quite a long time. And big investors, you know, are not interested in small projects. So once they succeed, somebody will put some more money in. And Bezos has said that he's going to put $1 billion a year into his company now. So that could help a lot. But his design isn't really the best design for a suborbital system, I don't think. So that there's no absolute surefire winner yet. And that's a bit like the early days of aviation, you know, when there were hundreds of companies building little aircraft. And, you know, gradually through competing and so on, the better ones became successful. And then there was the famous DC-3, Douglas DC-3, which was simply the best aircraft and sold, all the other companies would sell tens or hundreds of their vehicles, and the DC-3 sold more than 10,000 and so became the sort of the basic, the successful vehicle. So people are looking for what they call the DC-3 of space. In other words, a design which then lots of companies around the world will buy, just like the airline industry, you know, where you have the manufacturers and then you have the airline, the operating companies who then buy the vehicles.
But who exactly can become a space tourist? Right now, astronauts have to be at their fittest and go through rigorous trainings before they can go to space. Will space tourists have to go through the same kind of training? Patrick clears it up for us after this. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. We're talking about space tourism today with Dr. Patrick Collins from Azabu University, Japan. Elon Musk plans to send two people on a week-long trip around the moon next year. Seems a bit too soon, but do you think that's possible, Patrick?
Well, they've got a vehicle which they hope to carry passengers on. Okay. Now, it's an orbital vehicle, so it goes. The initial thing is to take people to the space station. And you remember NASA, it made a big change where it didn't make a follow-on to the space shuttle. So NASA can't send people to space at the moment. They are planning a new vehicle, but the private sector has this chance, and so SpaceX wants to do that. Unfortunately, their vehicle, they've done some test flights and so on, and they've had a failure in the test flight. And you know, when you develop a new vehicle like this, generally you often have, quite often there's an accident at some point. Doing test flights, that's okay, because you know, people don't know, it isn't carrying people. But you're trying to get good safety statistics. You know, safety just depends on statistics. If you've had 1,000 flights with no failures, you're very safe. If you've only had 10 flights and a failure, then 10% chance of failure. There's no way of escaping that. So if you can have a test flight series with no mistakes, you can get going very quickly. Once you've had one mistake, let's say on your fifth flight, your risk is very high, you see. And so they've had a failure, so that they're going to have to do a number of more test flights before they can carry astronauts, I think, to the space station. But as you say, there's also this offer to carry people around the moon. There's a standing offer in Russia, too, to use the Soyuz to do that. And it's about $100 million for the passengers to go on that. I don't know if they've really got customers. Maybe you've heard that they've got a firm customer. But the single risk is that something goes wrong with the vehicle. You know, once you're on the way, it's only about a week round trip there and back. But if anything goes wrong, you know, no one's going to come and save you because there's no other vehicles available to come and save you. You know? So it's quite a risk. You know, normally you would never fly on the send people on the first test flight of a new project like that. You see, you'd want to send a vehicle around the moon first and check out all the systems, and then you've at least got some data showing that it's going to work. So for anyone to pay $100 million to fly on it, even though it's never done it before, is a you know, there may be some youngish guys who try that, but it's a pretty hard sell, I would say.
So you say that with the future of space tourism, that anyone can become a space tourist. I mean, at the moment, it's only the very rich that can do it because it costs so much. But I'm thinking more of the, you know, now astronauts, the only people that are sent into space, astronauts are extremely fit people. But is it possible, really possible, for anyone, regardless of health status, to be able to go up into space and become a tourist there?
Yeah, it's a very good question. The current situation is, as I said, the FAA, so the American Federal Aviation Administration, have already established what they consider necessary health and safety rules for passengers on suborbital flights. And we remember, a suborbital flight, you get on a rocket or rocket plane, and then once the rocket engine is fired, you accelerate about 2 or 3 G, you know, a bit heavier than usual, for about a minute. The engine's then cut off, and you float in zero gravity for about 3 or 4 minutes. And then you come back, and when you hit the atmosphere, you again decelerate hard in your seat, and then you land. But it's not a very long trip. And so they say anyone, really basically anyone who would fly on an aircraft could take that trip. But there are 3 health risks, which they recommend on. The thing is that the aviation people, their attitude to health and safety for passengers on aircraft is quite different from NASA, you see. NASA decides who goes to space. The aviation people, they say, we want as many people to travel on aircraft as possible. That's our job. And so you probably know, anyone is allowed to fly on an aircraft if they buy a ticket. But they give advice. Under certain health conditions, we would advise you not to fly. And one of them is a woman who's, say, 8 or 9 months pregnant. And every year, people do have babies on aircraft, or women have babies on aircraft. And every year, some people die on aircraft, you know, if they have a serious heart condition and so on. People with heart disease, when you're in zero gravity, the blood flow around your body changes. And if you've got a weak heart, that might be bad for you. So they warn you against that. And then people who are taking medications for their brain, you know, for example, epileptics, the blood pressure in your head goes up once you're in zero gravity, because normally when we're standing here, the blood is being dragged down to your feet. But once that stops in zero gravity, the blood pressure in your head goes up a bit. And that might affect the drugs that you're taking. And the third one is women who are pregnant, because the fetus or the baby is very sensitive to radiation. And the amount of radiation above the atmosphere is considerably more than on the surface here. For us, it's like having a few x-rays a year, but, you know, pregnant women don't have x-rays on their baby, you know. But apart from those three risks, the FAA says, you know, anyone who wants to should be able to go. And they recommend a physical examination, such as people who do fly their own aircraft. If people have a private pilot's license, they take a medical test, and anyone who passes that should be fine to go to space, they say. For longer term, spending, you know, living in space or maybe working on a space hotel for 2 months at a time, there'll be more rigorous health tests. But basically, anyone who's in normal, fit condition can go. The reason why astronauts are selected so tightly is simply because of the cost. Every flight, you know, to space costs at least $100 million or hundreds of millions of dollars. And if halfway through the person gets sick, then it's a terrible waste. But it's not because there's any particular stresses in space.
Astronauts go through training before they go into space. Do space tourists have to go through some sort of training as well before they go into space?
Yeah, very interesting. At the moment, as you know, the only way to get to space is to fly on the Soyuz. And the Soyuz carries three people, and they're all crew members. So even people who pay $20 million as tourists, they have to learn Russian so they can talk to the other guys. And they also have to do training, because if there's an accident or something goes wrong, they have to be able to do something. You know, they have to play a part, you know, press the green button or open the hatch or whatever. So it takes about 6 months training in Star City in Russia. But that won't be necessary for pure tourists who are just like us on an aircraft. We're passive. We do what, you know, we just sit and have a drink and so on. So there won't be any need for 6 months training. But there's an opposite point, which is actually that part of the training is fun. You know, it's interesting learning about various things. Like, for example, you can go on an aircraft and get 20 seconds of zero gravity. So quite a lot of people who are going to pay, you know, a few thousand pounds or $3,000, whatever, for their flight will enjoy training so that the flight itself will, you know, would be up and down in a morning. But probably there will be, and indeed the companies are offering sort of package tours of several days, which includes some training, includes some, you know, learning about space travel and space flight. And there'll be a mock-up of the vehicle, and so you'll do some sort of getting in and out of it and talking to the pilots and you know, generally enjoying the build-up to the experience, if you like. And so there's no absolute necessity, but, you know, it's a bit like on an aircraft. There's the safety talk, you know, what happens if there's a crash, you know, what you have to do. So there's that. And it's a bit more than that because it's different from daily life. But it's not like even a week of needed training. But I think most people will enjoy doing it for a day or two, perhaps. Yeah.
So I'd like to talk about infrastructure now. Right now, I think the only hotel in space at the moment is the International Space Station, but that isn't exactly very leisurely, right? What infrastructure are we expecting to see in space sometime soon?
Right. From the business point of view, as I said, because money is very short, people are focusing on suborbital flights, and that's technically much, much the easiest way to start. The real objective, of course, is to get to orbit, and that requires much bigger vehicles. They use about 50 times as much fuel to get to orbit, because suborbital, you only have to go about 1 kilometer per second, but to get to orbit, you have to travel at 8 kilometers per second, and that uses a much more energy and fuel and so on. But once we get vehicles, once there are vehicles that can carry reusable vehicles that go up to orbit and come back down again and so on, carrying passengers there, then, of course, we need hotels in orbit. And the only place you can stay in orbit at the moment is, as you say, the International Space Station. But interestingly, just a couple of years ago, an American company called Bigelow Aerospace attached a module of their space hotel. They're a company set up to develop space hotels, and they've developed a number of modules, you know, sort of like a small room, really, with a hatch and a window and so on. And they worked with NASA and convinced NASA that it's safe, and NASA allowed them to attach it to the space station. So there is the first hotel module in space already. So it's not science fiction. And space hotels, once you start working on space hotels, it's really quite interesting because the architecture and construction, someone, is so different from the ground. One of the things, of course, is being zero gravity, things aren't very heavy. And so you can build much, much bigger structures on Earth at much lower weight. You know, let's say a building like a gymnasium here might weigh, the materials, if you weighed it, would be, you know, 10,000 tons or so. But you could make the same structure in orbit for about 100 tons. It's a bit like an aircraft. You know, aircraft carries now, big aircraft carries, what, 300 or 400 people. Well, a building containing 300 people would be at least 10,000 tons, whereas the aircraft is empty, is only a couple of hundred tons. So there's the process of building. The first space hotels would just be modules sent up and stuck together like the space station. But then as it gets cheaper and cheaper, people will then build larger rooms in orbit. You know, they'll send up the components and build a big room like a sphere or a big cylinder. Because the bigger the space you have, then the more fun it gets for playing in zero gravity, you know. And there's already a whole sort of subculture about zero gravity sports. All sports will be different in zero gravity, and people will be able to think up new ones. One of the famous ones being you can put on wings and fly, you know, in zero gravity. So that they'll build sports centers, you know, like with a diameter of 100 meters or something, you know, a bit like a sports stadium. And the potential for making interesting hotels in zero gravity is just fantastic. You can have you could imagine a big open space with plants in, you know, growing plants and leaves, you know, so like a three-dimensional garden or something like this. And swimming pool, a huge rotating swimming pool where you swim around the interior surface and so on. So that the growth of hotels in orbit is really going to be fantastic, interesting. Because of the potential. And another difference from buildings on Earth, you see, is that buildings on Earth, once you've built it, you don't generally change them. But in orbit, you can keep adding bits to the hotel. You know, you can add a swimming pool and then add a gymnasium or add a new restaurant or something like that.
We have the news coming up, but after this, we find out the role Malaysia will play in space tourism. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. The topic of today is space tourism, and my guest is Dr. Patrick Collins from Azabu University, Japan. He's been an advocate for space tourism and space economics for over 30 years now. Patrick, you argue that space tourism can bring about many benefits. What are some of them?
For me, you know, I'm a sort of economist, you know. For me, the single most important thing about it is the jobs it's going to create. You surely know the world economy is in a very weak state. All this century so far has been very poor growth, with very high unemployment in America, Europe, Japan, and of course lots and lots of other countries as well, so all the rich countries as well. And the single most important reason for this is lack of new industries. You know, older industries are always getting more efficient, you know, using more machinery and so on, so they don't need so many people. So for economic growth to continue, we need to continue new industries to be set up, which then employ lots of people. And so, of course, the one we live with today is the Internet, which is just amazing, exploding, revolutionary new industry, which is creating loads and loads of new jobs. But it's also destroying lots of jobs, as you know. You know, music shops and bookshops have almost disappeared already, you know, and self-driving cars would make around the world about 100 million people unemployed, you know. So that we need new industries to create new jobs. And the air travel industry around the world employs about 100 million people. If you include all the aircraft manufacturers, the component makers, the airports, the airlines, all the airline staff and maintenance and so on, and then all of the tourism places which are enabled by air travel. I mean, Malaysia is a good example. There's loads of brilliant tourist centers there. But without air travel, you know, they wouldn't be even a tenth as big as they are now. And so space travel, we see it as growing through three phases, suborbital, and then orbital, and then the third phase will be lunar travel, you know, going to the moon and back. Well, you know, people went to the moon 50 years ago. It isn't difficult. It's not in the slightest difficult. It needs some infrastructure, and of course it needs low-cost, reusable vehicles to get to orbit. But with those three phases, it's going to grow and grow and grow through the 21st century, just like air travel grew through the 20th century. And I think by the end of this century, there may well be a billion passengers a year doing space travel, because last century, in the year 2000, there were well over a billion passengers a year doing air travel. So I see the economic benefit, just creating jobs and restarting economic growth, as the single biggest sort of important reason for doing it. You know, a lot of space engineers, you know, in space station, in the space agencies, they tend to think of tourism as trivial. And I've worked with them a lot over the last 20 years. And they sort of say it's trivial. What we're doing is more important. But I simply don't agree. If the general public wants to buy this service, what's more important than that? I mean, the economy is there for us, for the general public. You know, it's not there for people who build a, you know, the space station, which costs $100 billion and employs, what, about 10 people? I mean, it's their way of thinking, I think, is just basically wrong. You know, I think the air travel industry is correct. The more people who fly on aircraft, the better, you know, because that's what they want to do. So to my mind, that's the single biggest benefit.
I also feel like with space tourism becoming a possibility that many, many people will have something truly new and exciting to look forward to.
Absolutely. Once space travel gets going, I think it'll just open a door to a much, much more interesting, you know, optimistic future with almost unlimited potential. Because we're talking about space tourism, but there's a whole other aspect, which is once it gets much, much, much cheaper to get to orbit, dozens of new industries will spring up in space. First of all, building on the moon, building cities on the moon, and then dome cities and so on. And then you probably know there are people already working on asteroid mining. Well, working on trying to get asteroid mining underway. Well, asteroid mining is fantastic. It's got a fantastic future, but it needs a demand in space, you see. So once we have hotels in space, there'll be guys. There are two teams already. The people who want to sell materials from the moon to the hotels, like aluminium and water ice and glass and things like that. Then there are guys who want to do that from the asteroids, you know, and there's going to be great competition with these businesses in orbit. And that will be enabled by space tourism. So jobs and then this kind of exciting vision of the future are what I think are the most important things. And then there are all sorts of other things, like the more work that's done in space, the less environmental pollution we need to have on the Earth. And there's a whole kind of cultural thing, you know, that our future, human's future, is just absolutely bright, you know, and I think everyone will cheer up a lot once they can see that, you know, we're not about, you know, there's this idea that, oh, we're reaching the end of economic growth. Absolute nonsense. We're just about to start the real phase of economic growth, which is expansion out into space.
Right. So I want to now move on to talk about the role of countries like Malaysia in space travel and in space tourism, because at the same, right now it seems like what and who are making the headlines are the big countries like America, for example. So
right.
What role is Malaysia, for example, playing in developing space tourism?
Right. Well, it's very interesting. I was contacted by some people who are now good friends and colleagues from Malaysia about 15 years ago, you know, and they were interested in space tourism, wanted to do things. And so I visited quite a few times now. I met quite a lot of business people and politicians and so on. And gradually the idea is, you know, getting quite well accepted that, you know, Malaysia can play quite a significant role. The reasons being, first of all, Malaysia has developed very well and it's got a very good aviation industry. You know, it's got these big airlines, big leading LCC, big airport, you know, and big LCC airport and so on. And it's got a big aircraft maintenance business. So lots of technicians, you know, trained to follow proper regulations and so on. And, you know, it's got helicopters and air force and this sort of thing. So it's got a good basis of aerospace knowledge. It also has a space agency and has, you know, it's had an astronaut and people who work with satellites and so on. But it hasn't yet started to build a satellite launcher. And that's a very good thing, because building a satellite launcher to take satellites to orbit is very expensive and has no real business prospect, because the total number of satellites launched in the world is very small indeed. So it would cost about $1 billion and then would be no real business. Whereas, you know, using suborbital vehicles is much, much lower cost. It's much more like aviation, and so can be done with much lower initial costs. And there's quite a few state governments in Malaysia which have looked into or started to look at, you know, possibility of having a spaceport. And I think a suborbital spaceport, you know, a suborbital spaceport doesn't actually need much infrastructure. In fact, you know, if you have a little space plane like a rocket plane, it can come in and land at an existing airport. And so long as there's trucks bringing the propellants it needs, it can fly out again. So it doesn't need a lot of upfront expense. But, of course, if it gets popular, then building a great space terminal building would be a great idea, because it would be a good business opportunity. And so there's discussions of, you know, doing a real estate development for a spaceport, which it could well be a good business opportunity itself, once these services start and once they can actually buy a vehicle. And so the fact that there's a group of people who are quite seriously interested now and looking into this is very encouraging. And there are people looking at, you know, the various spin-off activities, you know, with foreign tourists. Because a lot of foreign tourists come to Malaysia, because it's such a great place to visit, provide a service for foreign tourists, you know, because they can then go to the beach, visit the jungle and stuff, and then also take a trip to space and back. So I think building on Malaysia's great tourism industry, there's a very good sort of matching there of capabilities. And so I suspect that, you know, once orbital tourism gets underway, there'll be a big investment in Malaysia in an equatorial spaceport. And the sort of the timeline we're thinking of is the 20s are going to be the boom of suborbital. The 30s will then be the boom of orbital tourism, and the 40s will be the boom of lunar tourism. So if suborbital tourism goes well in the 20s, then I'm sure that there'll be huge, serious planning for an equatorial spaceport in Malaysia. And that, as you know, a big airport like KLIA is a huge business opportunity. And so maybe could be the sort of the hub spaceport for Southeast Asia.
Do you think you'll be able to be a space tourist in your lifetime at least? Because sometimes I struggle with that idea that I potentially, even in my lifetime, would not be able to go to space because it seems like something that's quite far away. And at the moment, it's also something that's quite expensive to do.
That's right. No, I'm absolutely sure I will. I'm 65, but I still haven't given up on my hope of going to the moon because technically it's absolutely straightforward. There is nothing that hasn't been done before. In terms of, you know, the technology needed, the engines, the power they need, and the vehicles, and so on. So it's just a question of money. The thing for lunar tourism is the infrastructure. We need to build things there. We need to build a spaceport there, build some, you know, accommodation, and so on. And so that needs a good deal of investment. But what's interesting is you've probably seen that over the last two or three years, India, China, Russia, European Space Agency, ESA, have all said they're going to build a base on the moon. And they tend to, you know, because they're space agents, they think of doing research and engineering and so on. But that's fine. But what they will do is they'll develop the technique for building construction on the moon. And, you know, like a lot of things, no one wants to be the first, you know, because when you do something revolutionary for the first time, you know, you make mistakes and it costs you things. A bit like Virgin, you see, they had a failure in their test flight, which set them back, you know. So everyone else can learn from that. So no one wants to be first. But once somebody's shown it's possible, then everyone else will pile in. And so it's quite possible, quite possible. I can't say it's likely yet because there's still a number of other problems like, you know, threats of war and so on. But it's very easy, technically, to have orbital tourism booming in the 30s, and in which case going to the moon will become quite straightforward. And, you know, every new business, they say that your early adopters, you know, the first people who are your customers who are quite happy to pay a high price. This is a very important role for rich people, you know. Quite a lot of people think, you know, rich people, you know, they resent them and stuff. But and some of them are not very nice characters, perhaps. But so long as they are prepared to spend money on new services, that's very useful for the companies developing the service. So once we can all go to stay in a hotel in orbit, you know, the rich will be then going to the moon, you see. So that there's a sort of way of opening up the path. And you can just rely on the tourism industry just to drive it to bigger and bigger and bigger scale, just like the LCCs, which are such a fantastic success. I mean, Air Asia and then Air Asia X. I come from Japan down to Malaysia. Air Asia X cut the price in half. Like, I was just absolutely amazed. You know, I thought it'd be 20% cheaper. No, the price cut in half. And it'll go down further, I'm sure.
That was Dr. Patrick Collins from Azabu University, Japan. If you know someone who wants to go to space, you can recommend this show to them. They can download the podcast from the BFM app. It's available on the Apple App Store and on Google Play. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.